soft kissing sounds of a chiller pack on the hunt. While the slaves silently marched past them, the mutants moaned and waved their handless arms for help.
Like we would if we could.
The matter was settled by the rumbling gait of an orwag. The vibration caused the pillar to crack at its narrowest point, tipping the stickies off into space. When they hit the razor-sharp edges of the blocks below and began to slide, they were sliced and diced, backs, fronts, thighs, faces, cut through the bone. They tumbled to the bottom of the chasm, leaving long bloody smears on the glass. Without shedding a single tear, the file of humanity struggled on. After another quarter-mile descent, the lowest point in the crater came into view. Their final destination, Ground Zero. It was a pancake-flat depression, roughly circular, 500 feet across, and stippled with shallow dimples like the rind of a moldy orange. In the light of the late afternoon sun, the glass looked more gray than green. To illuminate the area at night, it was ringed by a battery of Klieg lights on tripods. In the center were three great holes in the glass. They were swarmed with laborers going in and out. Parked beside the mine entrances were ore wags. They were being loaded by hand from crude carts on skids. From the edge of the ring of lights, battle-suited troopers stood guard with laser rifles. There was a large holding tank, presumably for water, which had its own guard. There were no sleeping or cooking facilities, but there were long open-flame heaters to keep the workers from freezing to death after the sun went down. In some of the shallow depressions, bodies were curled up. Whether sleeping or dead, it was impossible to tell. The group of fresh slaves was met at the end of the road by troopers who forced them into a long single file. As they passed a checkpoint, under tri-blaster muzzles, they were given another cup of water to drink, and a large plastic badge was pinned to their chests. After the last badge was handed out, one of the troopers addressed the crowd.
When the badge glows green, you are in an area of glass worth mining, and the glow will be bright enough to work by. If you bring out all that doesn't register bright enough, you'll get no water. If you don't fill your sledge up to the top, no water. If there are problems with quality or quantity, everyone assigned to that sledge pays the same price. No water.
Ryan looked down at his badge. It was already faintly glowing. There was no need to ask what that signified. They were in a death zone.
Bubblehead over there talked about giving us water, but he didn't mention anything about food. I think that means we're on our own in that area.
Might as well hang up a sign. Abandon hope, all ye who enter here.
We cannot do that. Standing at the gates of hell, hope is our only shield.
The troopers started using their rifle butts to herd the milling slaves in the mine entrance's direction.
Get a move on, dogs!
At a second checkpoint, the companions were each handed short-handled pickaxes and mesh bags for carrying ore. When all the new slaves had been given tools, the guards retreated to the outside of the ring. There were no further instructions, and the slaves weren't forced underground at Blaster Point. Their captors knew that thirst would do that quickly enough. Ryan and the others filtered over to one of the mine entrances. Beside the round hole was a cut-down oil drum with the words Baron Jolt stenciled on the side. Stuffed inside the drum was a man with matted gray hair. Obviously the victim of laser manacles, he had no hands or feet. While the companions watched, a slave came out of the mine, walked up to the half-drum, unzipped his fly, hauled out his Johnson, and proceeded to empty his bladder.
Please. Please stop. Have mercy.
Yeah, right.
Do you know who that is? That's Baron Doyle himself. From Baron to Urinal. God damn. Talk about a tough world.
Ryan was already circling to the other side of the entrance, where a group of slaves squatted in front of a 10-foot-long propane burner that served as a nighttime heat source. They were using 2-foot lengths of stiff wire to toast small, elongated objects over the open flames. The things had 4 stumpy legs and long tails.
Rats.
One of the slaves who was watching the others cook, a big, dirty, bearded man with spiral brands on his forehead and cheeks, slipped in from behind and deftly snatched another's rat on a stick.
Hey! Give that back!
Fuck you, bitch!
There was a brief scuffle for the hot food, which its original owner quickly lost. He seemed in very bad shape, and was far too weak to reclaim his meal. The stronger slave gleefully chomped down the well-browned rat, bones, crispy tail, and all. The victim turned away from the barbecue and staggered back toward the mine entrance with the intent of chasing down another dinner. Ryan did a double take as the man stumbled past. Though his face and hands were covered with weeping rad sores, and he was missing hair and most of his teeth, there was no mistaking the poor bastard.
Colonel Gabhart?
Dreda leaned her head forward and peered over the edge of the abyss.
Regretfully appropriate.
Striated new glass lined both sides of the yawning chasm. After a sheer drop of 500 feet, the nearly vertical walls began to curve together, like the folds of a glistening gray wound, one bulging over the other, forming a black crease of impenetrable shadow. Below the crease, the bottom fell out. Because of the way the walls overlapped, the maximum depth of the crevasse's second level couldn't be accurately measured by overflight sonar. Certainly it was thousands of feet, more than enough to keep scavenging animals from reaching Kira's corpse.
The perfect resting place, dear Kira.
Their battlesuit helmets off, their stubble-shaved heads lowered, the 10 surviving level 4 females clasped gauntlets in a mourning line along the verge of the Slake City precipice. Their dead comrade lay in a body bag at Dreda's feet. As Trask looked into the plummeting abyss, she flashed back to her father's state funeral, a miles-long procession with millions of mourners lined up to pay their last respects to the ornate armored coffin that was guarded by a full military escort, tanks, APC wags, combat troops, and hovering gyro squadrons. She realized that what she'd felt as her father's body rolled past the CEO's reviewing stand was nothing, absolutely nothing, compared to the emotion she was feeling now. At the time, she actually believed that she'd suffered a terrible, life-shattering loss. She had actually believed that she'd loved her father more than she could ever love anyone. Now she knew that she'd deluded herself. At her father's funeral, she'd merely been an actress, reading from a script written and produced by Regis Otis Trask. According to that, Dreda was as incapable of emotion as her father. With his lifelong neglect, his impeachability, he had trained her well for the part. A parent's unconditional love was never part of their relationship. A cold, grasping octopus of a creature, Regis Trask had planned, consciously or unconsciously, for her to turn out the same, a perfect reflection. And she had not disappointed him. She pushed those dark memories out of her mind and visualized Kira's face, recapturing the power of her beauty. Kira, like Dreda, like the others, had not yet fully blossomed. And now she never would. Her companionship and the joy it brought was likewise gone forever. Real tears streamed down Dreda's cheeks. Real grief twisted her heart. Her pain was physical, and it was enormous. Curious what a little dose of virus could do. It had given her sisters, where before she'd had none. It had given meaning to her life. Not only did the level 4 females have an implanted genetic heritage in common, but they also had a shared experience of transformation, and a common connected future that was still unfolding. They were, in fact, much closer than sisters. Despite the changes they had undergone, these women still saw themselves as women, only much improved. They knew that the male troopers called them shehis behind their backs, even though it was scientifically untrue, since there was nothing male about them. They allowed the practice to continue because the reference to their strangeness and physical prowess had discipline value. It kept the enlisted ranks in line without the need of force. In both universes, it had been fashionable at one time or another to speculate that there would be no wars if women ruled the world. There was no way to test the hypothesis, since women never had that kind of absolute global power in either reality. Dreda and her sisters subscribed to a slightly different idea, though. They believed that there would be war, but only one. This because women, if granted the means, would conquer utterly. They'd do the job right for the sake of their children. Their much more intimate connection with the future prepared them to take this longer view, and stick to it. History taught that in victory, men always had sympathy for the male foe they'd vanquished, that they always took pity because they could see themselves in his position, as if war were a jolly game to be played over and over, with alternating winners. Men were the reason nothing ever got solved. The level 4 females didn't view war.